KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I don't think this is a request. Is that difficult? I would ask my employees to let me know what they're doing.
A GOP senator defends Elon Musk's ultimatum to federal workers, justify in writing what you did at work last week or lose your job. For Sunday, February 23rd, it's All Things Considered. I'm Don Gagne. We take a drive to Windsor, Ontario, Detroit's next door neighbor, where they react to U.S. threats of tariffs and of making Canada the 51st state.
It's kind of like when your best friend goes and stabs you in the back.
And a newly discovered concert recording of the late, great Texas songwriter Guy Clark. It captures an artist still finding his way.
I can hear the hesitance. Like, am I really singing this song? Is this song finished? Is this song worth singing in front of an audience?
The things you find on an old cassette tape. First news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The U.S. Agency for International Development says it's firing 1,600 people in the U.S. as part of a reduction in force and putting nearly all of the rest of its workers around the globe on administrative leave at midnight tonight. In a memo, the agency says the exceptions are those working on mission-critical programs, core leadership, and employees supporting specially designated programs. This after a federal judge Friday ruled that the Trump administration could proceed with layoffs and administrative leave and close down operations overseas, forcing employees based abroad to come back to the U.S. The agency, though, says those coming back from overseas can expect their travel to be paid for by the government. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said earlier this month that he is the new acting head of the agency. And employees across the federal government got an email this weekend asking them to describe their work over the past week. But now, as NPR's Joe Hernandez reports, some other Trump administration officials are telling employees not to reply.
The email Saturday came from the Office of Personnel Management and arrived hours after Trump advisor Elon Musk said on social media that workers who didn't respond would lose their jobs. The email itself didn't say that. Musk has been tasked with cutting the federal government, and so far the administration has fired some 20,000 federal workers. But the email caused confusion in many parts of the government after other Trump administration officials told workers they didn't have to reply. New FBI Director Kash Patel told the agency's workforce that it would review its own processes and to hold off on replying to the email. The Defense Department also told employees not to respond, and the State Department said it would reply on workers' behalfs. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
In Lebanon, the former leader of Hezbollah, the militant Iran-backed group, has been laid to rest 5 months after being killed in an Israeli airstrike in Beirut. Tens of thousands turned out for his funeral. NPR's Jane Araf has more from Beirut.
The funeral was held at Beirut's biggest sports stadium, the only venue large enough to accommodate mourners. Nasrallah is one of the founders of Hezbollah, created to counter the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. His killing last September deeply shocked his followers and severely weakened the organization. But at the funeral, mourners and officials said he was more influential as what they consider a martyr than he was alive. They vowed to continue his path of resistance against Israel and the United States. Senior Iranian and Iraqi officials attended the funeral, along with what Hezbollah said were mourners from dozens of countries. Jane Araf, NPR News, Beirut.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Scientists say that for centuries, people have collected water from fog, but this practice has only recently been closely examined. NPR's Regina Barber has more on a study that attempts to harness fog to supply water for a lot more people.
Alto Especial lies in the Atacama Desert, and it's perfectly situated to collect fog. At about 2,000 feet in Chile,
Alto Especial is the only city which is inside of the cloud.
That's geographer Virginia Carter. She led a study that gathered data at various fog collection sites around the city for a year. In the past, fog collection has only been studied and used in small villages. But for the first time, Carter and her team used computer modeling to map how much water could be collected from fog all over the region. They found that fog could supply hundreds of thousands of liters of drinking water per week. enough to supplement the water demands of under-resourced parts of the city. Regina Barber, NPR News.
At the weekend box office, Captain America: Brave New World took the top spot for the second weekend in a row with $28 million in ticket sales. The Anthony Mackie-led installment in the Marvel franchise has been slammed by critics, though, and audiences have also graded it poorly with a B-minus cinema score. But the movie has grossed $289 million around the world. In second place, the horror film The Monkey, adapted from a Stephen King short story, with $14 million. It cost a reported $10 million to make. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne, in for Scott Detrow. As a Detroit native and current resident of the city, I've had a front row seat to what President Donald Trump's proposed tariffs are doing to U.S. relations with Canada, not to mention his recent comments about turning it into the 51st state. In fact, there may be no better real-time example of the deterioration than the long-standing bond between my hometown and its neighbor across the river, Windsor, Ontario. I took NPR producer Lauren Hodges to Detroit's Riverside Park under the Ambassador Bridge, where we could look across the Detroit River to Canada, not even a half mile away. This is the busiest commercial border crossing in North America. The Ambassador Bridge is right there to our right, a still under construction second span called the Gordie Howe International Bridge, named after Canadian native and Detroit hockey great, Gordie Howe. And that bridge, to me, named after Howe, symbolizes the many connections between the U.S. and Canada and this narrow span that separates them. I grew up on the Detroit side, watching Canadian television, listening to Canadian radio stations. Hockey night in Canada was a regular staple in our house. Friends on the Windsor side work in Detroit, come over to watch Detroit Tigers or Detroit Lions games in person. Detroiters eat in their restaurants. Windsorites eat in our restaurants. It's just kind of amazing the connections between the people of these two cities. All of this place kind of wrapped up in a single identity, some of us Americans, some of us Canadians. We then made the very short drive across the river and pulled out our passports at the border. At the checkpoint, we got the standard questions: where are we headed, what's our business in Canada, do we have any weapons in the car? Then the customs officer quickly turned into a concierge, giving us recommendations for lunch.
What's the restaurant called?
Called Twisted Apron. Closes at 3.
Thank you so much.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Yep. Welcome to Canada. Have you ever had a border crossing experience like that?
I really, really haven't.
And that kind of hospitality isn't just on the Canadian side. In fact, there's a pretty famous bus tour run by a local Windsor business that takes Canadians into Detroit for an hours-long bar crawl.
We're taking you on a boozy adventure through the grittiest, most iconic dive bars the Motor City has to offer. You'll hop on the most epic party bus of your life, where the good times roll and the karaoke never stops. Between bars, you and your crew will be belting out your favorite tunes and living it up like rock stars. These tours are legendary and sell out faster than you can say cheers. So, do you have your passport ready?
That voice is Adriano Ciottelli, who runs Windsor Eats, an event planning business that highlights local food and activities around Windsor. But he says Detroit was always included.
Visiting sporting games, events, concerts, that's almost a rite of passage for a lot of Windsorites to kind of jump on the tunnel bus, head over, get dropped off on Detroit, and just wander around and just enjoy a day or two or a weekend in Detroit.
And while it's been an extremely popular piece of his business, usually selling out even in the colder months, he's also aware that the tours really help out some of those smaller bars on the Detroit side.
There's another one in Hamtramck, which would reach out to us after every tour and essentially tell us, you know, you made us able to keep our lights on at the end of the month. They were so thankful every time that we would visit them.
But since Donald Trump's re-election and all the rhetoric that's been hurled at Canada,
I think they have to become the 51st state.
Windsor Eats made the tough decision to pause the beloved Detroit bar crawl.
And it's unfortunate that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's little businesses like this that are, and people that are going to be hurt.
Ciottelli calls what the U.S. administration is doing a very personal attack.
It's kind of like when your best friend goes and stabs you in the back.
It's a common thread among Windsorites we interviewed, a sense of betrayal. And though the potential tariffs are the more immediate and economic threat, as Trump lays out here,
I think Canada, you know, they're going to have to pay tariffs on automobiles, lumber, and oil and gas, et cetera, et cetera.
It's Trump's repeated talk of Canada as the 51st state that really seems to rile people up the most.
You know, it's just sort of preposterous for us to think about this, that we're at this point in time, and we're not even quite sure how we got there.
That's Windsor Mayor Drew Dilkins. We drove to his office at City Hall downtown, where we saw many flags in red and white with the iconic maple leaf hanging from apartment balconies and local businesses. Dilkins is also a big fan of the Tigers and the Lions, and just like many Windsor natives, has many fond memories of traveling into the U.S. to cheer on Detroit sports teams in person. And remember when Canadian hockey fans booed the U.S. national anthem at an NHL game in Montreal this month? Then, a few nights ago, U.S. fans in Boston reciprocated by booing the singing of O Canada. Mayor Dilkins is saddened by all of it. But even as he has taken steps, official ones, to make a statement, he ended city subsidies for a transit service that helps fund an hourly commuter bus to Detroit for his constituents.
I just can't act as an economic engine to Detroit at a time when we're being economically threatened by the President of the United States. Just can't get my mind around it.
And one more thing got sacrificed as relations started to ice over. The mayor pulled the city's sponsorship of the annual Detroit Grand Prix.
And in true Canadian form, let me tell you, I apologize for having to do that. And I recognize it's a pebble in the ocean, like the ripple. I'm not changing the world by doing these two things, right? But it's a signal.
Dilkins knows that stuff like canceling bus lines and sponsorships might seem small.
I don't have any other arrows in the quiver, right? I have nothing else I can fire back. I have nothing else I can do. I have no other way except using my voice to express my dissatisfaction and my feeling about this.
A sign of more than just hurt feelings, he says he's even heard rhetoric accusing Canada of taking advantage of the U.S., specifically within the auto industry. And he has a passionate response to that as well.
No, we built it together. We have built this thing together. When Chrysler announces they're building a new car factory in Detroit, like, we would light fireworks off here because we think that's amazing for our region. Just as you should celebrate when we build a $6 billion battery factory, that raises your boat as well in the United States. It's great for everybody.
Meanwhile, in a recent speech, the chairman of the Ford Motor Company warned that the threatened tariffs and their impact on tight supply chains would, quote, blow a hole in the auto industry that would affect both countries. Mayor Dilkins, meanwhile, says it's more than pride, that it's all very scary.
And none of us are foolish enough to think that the United States doesn't have the military might, if they want and choose, to take over Canada. We'd put up a good fight. We'd probably lose. We know that. But the thought that that's where we are, all of a sudden, with a snap of a finger, is abhorrent to us. You have to understand Canadians. Like, they'll just become more, it's a rallying cry to pull together even tighter.
So, as evening approaches, we head back over the river and into Detroit. Our next stop is one of the dive bars from the canceled tour. Then we get a text.
Oh, it's her.
It's the bar owner. She won't be there. In fact, she says they're not open much anymore these days. NPR's Lauren Hodges produced this piece. This weekend, President Trump told Elon Musk to be more aggressive with the Department of Government Efficiency, a team that's already fired tens of thousands of federal workers. Soon after this directive from Trump, Musk gave federal employees an ultimatum. Report what you accomplished this past week or lose your job. Now, some of Trump's cabinet members are telling their workers to skip Musk's requests, sparking confusion. NPR's Luke Garrett reports.
On Saturday, the Office of Personnel Management sent an email to federal workers requesting 5 bullet points of what they've done in the last week. Meanwhile, Elon Musk posted on X, his social media platform, that failure to respond will be taken as a resignation. The tech billionaire defended the OPM email as a way to root out fraud and as a, quote, basic pulse check. But some agency leaders, like FBI Director Kash Patel and defense officials, are telling their workers to hold off on answering this email. On Sunday, Republican Senator John Curtis of Utah defended Musk on CBS News.
I don't think this is a request. It is that difficult? I would ask my employees to let me know what they're doing.
Yet Curtis also admitted the way Musk is running Doge has been too difficult on federal workers.
If I could say one thing to Elon Musk, it's like, please put a dose of compassion in this. These are real people.
Meanwhile, at the Conservative Political Action Conference, also known as CPAC, Musk wielded a chainsaw and promised to continue his efforts to reduce the size of the government.
This is the chainsaw for bureaucracy.
And Trump took a victory lap at the conference and celebrated the creation of Doge,
which is now waging war on government waste, fraud, and abuse. And Elon is doing a great job.
Federal workers have until midnight Monday to respond with their bullet points of accomplishments or risk losing their jobs. The American Federation of Government Employees, a union that represents nearly a million civil servants, said they challenge any job losses in court. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Several federal agencies, including the State Department, the FBI, and the Pentagon, are telling their staff not to comply with a request from White House advisor Elon Musk to summarize their work accomplishments last week or risk losing their jobs. The email went out yesterday with a deadline tomorrow at midnight. This is President Trump and Musk work to shrink the federal government. Pope Francis remains hospitalized in critical condition with double pneumonia. The Vatican says the 88-year-old is alert and well-oriented. And at the weekend box office, Captain America Brave New World took the top spot for a second weekend in a row with $28 million in ticket sales. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. Former Congresswoman Lori Chavez de Remer is President Trump's pick to head the Labor Department. And this past week, during her confirmation hearing, she made her case before Congress.
In 2024, our nation witnessed the single greatest political achievement of our time. President Trump has united a new coalition of working class Americans like never before.
Her nomination is notable because she's a Republican with a pro-labor reputation. As a member of the U.S. House, Chavez de Remer co-sponsored a bill called the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or the PRO Act. It's a bill that would provide protections for workers trying to organize, and it is and has been a top priority for labor unions. But her hearing raised questions about where she actually does stand on that issue. She told senators she supports the PRO Act, but not when it's in conflict with individual states' right-to-work laws, which undermine unions. Here she is in an exchange with Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who strongly opposes the PRO Act.
I fully, fairly, and support states who want to protect their right to work. I have said that to every senator that I have visited.
So you no longer support the aspect of the PRO Act that would have overturned state right-to-work laws?
Yeah. There were so many parts.
That's a yes?
Yes. There. Yes, sir.
No more questions.
Her nomination comes at an interesting time as President Trump professes to represent the interests of working Americans. Thousands of federal workers are being laid off. At a Capitol Hill rally protesting those layoffs earlier this month, Democratic Congressman Brendan Boyle accused Republicans of hypocrisy.
You know, election time in my area and other areas, when you hear a certain Republican members on TV talking about, you know, I'm very bipartisan. I'm not anti-labor. I love labor.
Yeah.
Some of my best friends are union members. Here's a chance for them to show it.
Yeah.
Stand up for the men and women who are working for this country.
Joining us now to talk about the labor secretary nominee and what this pick signals to us about President Trump's priorities is a longtime labor analyst, Harley Shaken of the University of California, Berkeley. Harley, thanks for being here.
Very good to be here.
Can we do some civics 101 just to start? Briefly describe what is the role of the Labor Department.
Well, the Labor Department does a number of things. It protects wages and hours. It looks into other areas that affect working Americans. And it also creates a voice within an administration for workers, or that ostensibly is what it's meant to do.
So Lori Chavez de Remer is not on the job yet as labor secretary. The confirmation vote in the Senate should come soon. But in terms of her rhetoric and even her background and time in office as a mayor and as a one-term member of Congress, she is a Republican who has a reputation as being pro-labor. How would you characterize her views on labor?
Well, I think there are really two Lori Chavez de Remers. One is the person you've just described as a moderate Republican in a swing district. She came out strongly for two pieces of legislation, the PRO Act, which you mentioned, and a similar act extending the right to organize to public workers who don't have it today. And that was cheered by labor, so she ran with labor support. She lost narrowly this last November, but the second Lori Chavez de Remer has been the person we heard in the confirmation hearing, this is someone who seems to be channeling President Trump and effectively saying not simply that she serves at the pleasure of the president, which any cabinet nominee does, but rather that she will adhere to all aspects of his labor agenda, which in many areas has been and likely will be very critical against labor.
The labor secretary is a cabinet-level position, but there's another government entity that plays a major role, perhaps an even larger role, in establishing the rights of workers, the rights of labor unions, and what happens in any given workplace. That's the National Labor Relations Board. It's called the NLRB. It has commissioners appointed by the president. And depending on the political makeup of that board, it can support or undermine Labor Department policies. Is that a fair way to put it?
That's a very accurate way to put it. And there's always changes that are made, but President Trump has gutted the board initially so that it no longer has a quorum.
It has five members. It needs three for a quorum. Currently, there are two because of two firings by President Trump. And there was a vacancy. Is that right?
That is correct.
So what's that mean if we have an NLRB with no quorum?
It can do nothing. It can't enact or review anything in a defining way until that quorum is restored. And President Trump did that also with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. He basically fired enough members of that board so that there isn't a quorum, so that can't operate either, which also affects workers.
What do you say to people who say the president was elected, and the president was elected with stronger than normal for a Republican support from unions and working people, and because of that, this is his right?
Well, the president was elected based on doing things for working people and making workers more secure and better paid in terms of an economy that's functioning. He's not going to be delivering that given the direction in which he's moving right now. We are seeing a preview of Trump's labor policies with how he is dismantling huge chunks of the federal government. That isn't something different. It is put in the guise of efficiency. We're getting rid of corruption and bloat. But there are human lives at stake of very talented individuals who have devoted their lives to public service. And we've treated them in a peremptory and really destructive way. If that is a preview of broader labor policies, we're in for a rough ride.
It's hard to see, in your view, this labor secretary pushing back hard against that.
I think that is very difficult to see. She's in a very untenable position given the Trump administration's policy to date when it comes to unions, but we'll see what'll happen.
We've been talking to labor economist Harley Shaken. He is an emeritus professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Harley, thank you.
Thank you.
When it comes to fighting opioids, designating drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations does a lot more harm than good. That's according to Vonda Felbab-Brown of the Brookings Institution. She directs the think tank's program on the fentanyl epidemic in North America and is an expert on international organized crime. In a recent essay in Foreign Affairs, she argues that terrorism designations and tariffs, both central to President Trump's plan to slow the flow of opioids, would be disastrous. But she also says that threatening the use of such methods could be useful. Vonda Felbab-Brown joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Donna. It's a pleasure to be with you on the show.
You write about the two tools the Trump administration is using to deal with illicit opioids coming into the U.S., tariffs and designating cartels as these foreign terrorist organizations. Briefly, can you explain your number one concern with each approach? Let's start with the tariffs.
Absolutely. So the Trump administration really moved U.S. drug policy into absolutely new domains when it linked it to tariffs and applied very vast tariffs to U.S. neighbors and core U.S. ally Canada, as well as to Mexico and to China. And the risk, of course, is that the tariffs will have vast negative economic consequences for each of the country, including the United States. At the same time, if the tariffs are not removed, if there is compliance with the counter-narcotics demands that the Trump administration has issued, they become meaningless. They just hurt the economy.
And then let's look at the other piece of that, the use of the foreign terrorist organization designation. What's your concern there?
Well, the problem with FTO, the FTO designation, is that it really does not provide many expansive law enforcement tools that are not there in the first place, but it comes with very expensive, extensive, and vague material support clauses. Those are material support clauses that state by U.S. laws that any kind of material support, as little as a cup of water, can be prosecuted under U.S. laws. And there are some exceptions to U.S., but they don't always hold up in U.S. courts and, for that matter, in international courts.
Just to underscore that point regarding the terrorist organization designation, it sounds like you're saying, too, it would be bad because cartels are often actually involved with a wide array of legal businesses. What's the issue there?
Absolutely. So these days, drug trafficking organizations do not solely traffic in drugs, or for that matter, are not solely engaged in illegal activities. Certainly in Mexico, they have reached unprecedented level of power. And extortion of legal economic activities is a common day occurrence by just about all of the criminal actors in Mexico. And worse than that, the Mexican cartels are even directly trying to take over parts of legal economies. This is true in agriculture, in fisheries, in mining, all kinds of extractives, in trucking. They not just extort the companies, they in fact own parts of the enterprises. Now, this is very bad. It's bad for Mexico, and it's certainly bad for the United States. And making a concerted effort to roll back their activity from legal economies is crucial.
To put it in the simplest terms possible, an above-the-board, let's say an American company, may be doing business with a business they think is legal but has some ties to the cartel somewhere, and that would put that initial company, that American company, at risk.
Absolutely. So the material support clauses require knowingly providing material support. But U.S. actors, whether individuals or companies, are required to do due diligence. And so there is only so much leeway that they can argue that they did not know that their counterpart with whom they dealt in Mexico was paying, for example, extortion fees or had parts of the business infiltrated by the cartels.
Traditionally, diplomacy and law enforcement cooperation have been the norm in dealing with this issue. Certainly, there are people who say, why not try this different approach? How do you respond to that kind of a statement?
Well, the difficulty of trying something that is so disruptive to relations is that it is difficult to unwind. So you can apply tariffs and you can eventually back away from them because the other country applies counter tariffs. And this is indeed a situation where we are with China. President Trump also issued a 10% fentanyl-linked tariff on China. China did not budge, did not offer more extensive law enforcement assistance so far. Instead, it applied counter tariffs at 15%. And so eventually, we will likely see bargaining between the two countries that might well result in the suspension and weakening of the counter narcotics cooperation that did take place in 2024 after a long several year pause. And we will be sort of back at the starting point, at line zero in restarting cooperation. And we have wasted time.
That was Vonda Felbab Brown of the Brookings Institution. You can read her piece, The New War on Drugs in Foreign Affairs. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News. Early projections of Germany's national election show that Friedrich Merz, the candidate for the center-right Christian Democrats, is poised to become the country's next chancellor. His conservative bloc emerged as the biggest vote-getter, nearly 10% ahead of the far-right Alternative for Germany party. NPR's Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz joins us now to discuss the results. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Don.
So, Rob, what was the issue that turned this election?
Well, Germany has no shortage of issues, but this year the economy was probably the biggest one. Germany's economy has been struggling for years, and Chancellor Olaf Scholz's government collapsed over an argument about how to revive it.
So Olaf Scholz is likely on his way out, making way for the new chancellor. Will Merz be able to quickly form a new government?
He would love to, but it's too early to tell who he needs to talk to in order to make that happen. German parliamentary elections are sort of a numbers game, and the next step for Merz hinges on whether a couple of parties that, according to exit polls, receive just under 5% of the vote stay under that number. A party needs 5% in order to serve in the German parliament, and if the exit polls stay firm, then Merz will likely only need to enter into coalition talks with one other party, and that's Olaf Scholz's Social Democrats. Here's what Merz said this evening about upcoming coalition talks.
Die Welt da draußen wartet nicht auf uns.
And Don, he's saying here that the world is not waiting for Germany and it does not have time for lengthy coalition negotiations. Merz said, we have to start governing as soon as possible so that Germany can do the right thing both in Europe and in Germany.
The party that came in second place is the far-right Alternative for Germany party. It's a party that Elon Musk has been championing. Are they being considered to serve in some capacity in Germany's next government?
Most likely not. All of Germany's mainstream parties have vowed not to govern with this party, known by its acronym in German, the AfD. This is a party that is under domestic surveillance due to the threat it poses to Germany's democracy, and its members routinely trivialize Germany's atrocities in World War II. But the co-leader of the AfD, Alice Weidel, is still holding out hope. Here's what she said this evening. She's saying here that the AfD is extending its hand to Merz's CDU party to, what she says, honor the will of the people, and that she is open to coalition negotiations, and all the CDU has to do is take our hand. But it is clear that the AfD's hand might be dangling there for some time because Merz has promised he will not govern with them.
So what kind of chancellor will Merz be?
Well, unlike outgoing Chancellor Olaf Scholz, it's clear that Merz is more interested in bringing Europe together to build a stronger force that can stand up to Russia. Scholz has for years been criticized for not doing enough in this realm, and Merz believes in a strong Europe. He believes in free markets. He's a former board member of the German branch of BlackRock, the largest asset management company in the world, and he wants to make it easier for businesses to deal with Germany's bureaucracy.
Any idea how he'll deal with President Trump?
He'll be diplomatic but firm. I think he's going to fight to have Germany be at the table when it comes to talks with Russia and Ukraine. I think he'll have a stronger relationship with Europe's other big power, France, especially when it comes to making sure that Russian President Vladimir Putin is kept in check. But the key to all of this is how quickly he can form a government, because in the past it takes months. And with the way the world is changing now, Germany does not have months.
That's NPR Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Growing up in a South African township, Abel Salauchwe decided his cello could be more than an instrument. It could be a bridge across cultures and genres. Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Janine Herbst with these headlines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he's willing to step down for the security of his country and if Ukraine gets into NATO. He made the comment today, a day before the third anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Early projections of Germany's national parliamentary election show that Friedrich Merz, the candidate for the center-right Christian Democrats, is poised to become the country's next chancellor. His party got nearly 10% more than the far-right Alternative for Germany party, or AfD. This over voter concerns about the economy and immigration. And prayers for Pope Francis are pouring in from around the world as he remains hospitalized in critical condition with double pneumonia. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card VentureX. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. There's an important part of the story of how America got to the moon that you probably don't know. A new podcast from LAS Studios and Reasonable Volume wants to change that. Called The Other Moonshot, it reveals the untold story of three black aerospace engineers in Los Angeles and the crucial roles they played in the Apollo program. One of those men is Charlie Cheatham, the godfather of the show's host, Joanne Higgins. Here's Joanne with an excerpt of The Other Moonshot.
Everything you've heard about the moon landing usually starts on a stage at Rice University in Houston, Texas, September 12, 1962. President Kennedy is at the podium wearing a black suit.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, for we meet in an hour of change and challenge, in a decade of hope and fear, in an age of both knowledge and ignorance. The greater our knowledge increases, the greater our ignorance unfolds.
The people behind him are wiping their foreheads with handkerchiefs and squinting into the sun. That day, he gave one of his most impassioned speeches.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills.
It was meant to inspire the country. It didn't work on everyone.
I don't believe a sane government is going to do any kind of crazy crap like going to the moon.
Charlie was 33 years old when he heard that speech. He was living on the edge of Compton. He was working as an engineer at North American Aviation, a major American aerospace manufacturer. But Charlie was not inspired. He thought the whole thing was nuts.
The notion of going to the moon, I didn't think our Creator was going to let us go off the face of the earth and screw up the heavens. As a black man, they can't handle this down here on earth. So I don't want nothing to do with that thing.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying.
To be fair, most black people were not big fans of the moonshot.
Because Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon.
This spoken word poem is by the great American poet and musician Gil Scott-Heron. Whitey on the Moon, published now by Ace Records, was released in 1970. It channeled almost a decade of frustration. What it was like watching America's achievement in aerospace overshadow the struggle for equality.
How come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon.
Both Gil and Charlie, They wanted the government to deal with the challenges down here.
To Whitey on the moon.
In 1962, the Voting Rights Act had not been written yet. School desegregation was less than 10 years old.
The white population are determined to prevent colored students from going to the school their own children attend. Picketing the school, they clash with the police.
That's footage from 1957, taken by Movietone News, showing the violent school desegregation in Arkansas. Kennedy believed his moonshot would open up opportunities for people of color. That's why black Americans voted for him, because he promised to focus on civil rights. But the government seemed to be going back on that promise. Instead of fixing the problems here on American soil, millions of dollars were being spent on rockets. Despite Charlie's initial reaction to Kennedy's speech, he went on to become one of the most important aerospace engineers on the Apollo project, a remarkable transformation for someone who did have and still has very complicated feelings about one of America's greatest achievements. I was really intensely curious about what it was like for him and how did he do it? This was a question I'd been trying to get an answer to all my life. Most of that time, I knew the basic outline of how Charlie became an aerospace pioneer. The story starts in Southern California at North American Aviation, where Charlie worked. The company was awarded a contract to work on the moonshot. They were responsible for the second stage rocket and one of the most important pieces, the command module, which housed the astronauts. At North American Aviation, most of the people Charlie worked with were white, but there were a handful of black engineers, including Charlie, who were instrumental in getting Apollo to the moon. When I think about the Apollo rocket mission in the 1960s and what it took to get there, the version I play in my head is like that scene in the movie The Right Stuff, where Ed Harris is walking through the airplane hangar, flanked by a crew of flannel-wearing pilots. They're ready to change the world. But in my version of this story, Charlie is Ed Harris, strutting in slow motion with a crew of well-dressed black engineers by his side. Engineers like Nate Levert, science fiction lover, Air Force veteran, avid golfer.
Boy, look at that. My unit's gonna fly.
Nate designed the engine propellant system for the second stage rocket and worked on all of the Apollo launches. Shelby Jacobs, novelty pipe collector, skier, champion bridge player, rocket propulsion engineer.
I was never limited to my own limitations.
Shelby designed the camera system that went up in the Apollo 6, the same camera system that took the very first photos of the Earth's curvature from space.
I didn't ask to work on the cameras that came and got me because they knew that I was a can-do kind of guy.
In my mind, the first wave of black engineers of North American aviation, like Charlie, Nate, and Shelby, they all get the hero's walk because the Apollo mission had a problem. And this team of engineers, these are the heroes who have come to save the day. In my head, that's what should have happened. In reality, their drive and persistence got them in the door. But the door was only open because the government mandated it. North American hired black workers as a part of a 1961 executive order by John F. Kennedy. It required government contractors to, quote, take affirmative action to ensure that applicants are treated without regard to their race, creed, color, or national origin. Kennedy wanted space to be for everyone. But was it?
See, when people aren't willing to do bad you, which they did daily to me in the company and my other fellow black people, it rips your guts out.
I grew up listening to Charlie, and I knew a lot of his story. But most people have never heard of him. I mean, you can't even Google his name. Something that really rubs Charlie the wrong way. Somehow, he and Nate and Shelby and others, they've been forgotten. This is my attempt to correct the record. I wanted the world to know about these incredible men who were born in the early 1900s, who grew up on farms, whose parents picked cotton, who were told because of their skin color they could not become engineers, ever, and who refused to listen. They took us on an unforgettable ride to places that no human had ever been before. Frankly, the time for them to tell their stories is running out.
What happened to us in our space? It's been a hell of a ride.
We're going to reveal the untold story of the men behind one of our greatest scientific achievements and one of our biggest societal failures.
Ignition sequence start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Launch commit. Liftoff. We have liftoff. Houston is controlling.
And it is one of the great adventures of all time.
That was an excerpt from The Other Moonshot, a podcast from LAist Studios and Reasonable Volume. You can find all the episodes wherever you get your podcasts. I'm lucky enough to have seen Guy Clark perform, I don't know, maybe a dozen times, probably more than that over the years. The first was sometime in the mid-80s, and by then he was already Guy Clark, living legend, songwriter's songwriter.
I can just get off of this LA freeway without getting killed a car.
But before Guy Clark was that Guy Clark, he was a 28-year-old, still struggling to make it as a songwriter, standing in front of a small audience in a coffee house at the University of Houston in 1970.
Hill country blues is all I see, rolling into Austin, looking for thee.
His opening act that night was a high school student named John Koontz. He asked Clark if he could record the set, and Guy said yes.
John passed this cassette recorder around to his friends, and I heard from a few of these friends that they played the tape until it broke, and the reel-to-reel or whatever he first recorded on was lost.
That's Tamara Saviano, friend, producer, and expert in all things Guy Clark. She says that everyone thought that recording was lost forever. But then,
in 2021, John was cleaning up his house and stumbled upon one copy of this cassette tape.
That recording eventually made its way to Saviano and her studio, and it will be released on February 28th. I asked Saviano which track stood out to her.
Step Inside My House, that's the first song Guy wrote. And so that one always, I'm kind of listening differently to hear how this song progressed as Guy would play it.
Step inside my house, babe, I'll sing for you a song. And I'll tell you about where I've been. It shouldn't take too long.
Guy always thought that that was an unfinished song. So I can hear the hesitance. Like, am I really singing this song? Is this song finished? Is this song worth singing in front of an audience?
It sure is nice from right over here when the light's a little dim.
He never recorded it in a studio setting, but he would play it live in Houston, and it was passed around from songwriter to songwriter in Houston. So someone would hear Guy play it, and then they'd play it, and that's how it made its way to Lyle Lovett, who later recorded it.
Step inside this house, girl, I'll sing for you a song.
He does 18 songs on this record. 6 of them are covers, songs he didn't write. He does a very well-known Jackson Browne song. He does These Days.
And I had a love. I don't think I'll risk another.
He
he sure makes it a Guy Clark song here, even though I know every word is a Jackson Browne song.
He does, and I found myself wondering, how did he find this song? You know, where did he find These Days?
I found a 1967 version of that song recorded by Nico on that Velvet Underground Banana record.
Well, that makes sense. Okay. I couldn't figure out how he got the song.
Music aside, what do you hear in here?
The first track is called Susanna. And any time that Guy writes about Susanna or talks about his love for Susanna, that intrigues me.
Susanna, let your hair down on me, cover up the blues.
They had such an interesting relationship from the very start, how they met, through Susanna's death, and then also headed back to California, which is also talking about that relationship with Susanna.
All the way from California, I have come to see you smile again.
This is the very early days of their relationship. So to hear Guy sing Headed Back to California about Susanna, about his commitment already to Susanna and his love for Susanna just months into their relationship, that just really struck me.
From the Greyhound station to your door, I turned around 10 times or more.
We're coming up on a decade since Guy passed away. He was 74 years old. You've spent a lot of time working his legacy and thinking about his legacy in the years since. How does this contribute?
Well, I think, you know, there are a lot of us who know who Guy Clark is, and we love Guy Clark, and we appreciate him as the artist that he was. But Guy is not a household name. And so anything that we can add to that legacy to bring in new people, to be able to say, here's something new for the people that already love Guy, and here's something you might want to hear if you've never heard of Guy.
Picking up lines that someone lost upon my street, singing them back to the tapping of my feet.
Tamara Savignano is the creative director and president of Guy Clark LLC and the Guy Clark Family Foundation. Tamara, thanks for sharing these stories with us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here with you, Don. Thank you.
I'm looking for words that say you're really looking fine today. Looking for the words that say you're always on my mind.
That was All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. Thank you for joining us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from Subaru, who, along with its retailers, is partnering with Operation Warm to provide more than 130,000 children in need with brand new necessities like coats, shoes, and socks. Subaru, more than a car company. This is NPR.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.